club-wielding Bray, a splash of blood spurting across his brutal visage. "Groth, weak! Groth, coward! Shagrak, eat Groth flesh!" Despite his bold boast, Sorgas saw that Shagrak was not going to tackle Groth alone. While the Bestigor circled the herd chief, three of his warriors were also moving to surround their former leader. Before the circle could close, an arrow whistled out of the night and embedded itself in the throat of a pig-faced Gor. Togra and the other scouts came rushing back, hurling themselves into the fight. Sorgas was puzzled as to why the scouts would risk themselves in such a manner when they could have slipped away in the confusion. Then he saw that the beastkin were not alone. Sorgas drew more power into his spell, binding the shadows still more tightly around him. He sensed others moving in the darkness. Their scent was not that of beastkin, nor was it entirely like that of any human he had ever encountered. When they drew near enough that he could make out their shapes, the shaman saw them to be squat and broadly built, moving with a hunched and ambling gait. Cries of alarm rose from the feuding beastkin as the scent of the lurkers reached them. Those already locked in combat exerted themselves in a frenzy to bring down their opponents quickly. The beastkin not engaged in battle turned and stared at the darkness, challenging the new enemies they sensed closing in on them. For Groth and Shagrak, there could be neither truce nor mercy. With his supporting warriors either brought down by Togra or else turning to face the lurkers, Shagrak found himself alone in his challenge with a chieftain. The realization sent the Bestigor running amok. Stamping his hooves, waving his horned head from side to side, he rushed at Groth, seeking to impale the herd chief upon the tip of his glaive. Sorgas let his attention shift away from the hunters that were closing on the beastkin. He fixated on the fight between herd chief and challenger. A minor spell could have been enough to tip the balance either way, but the shaman was not going to interfere. Whichever of them was strongest would prevail. That would be the one to take into the mountain. Groth swung away from Chagrak's charge. While he saved himself from being impaled on the glaive, he was not so agile that he escaped the Bestigor's raking horns. His face was split open from cheek to jaw by the challenger. Shagrak brought himself around in time to fend off the auric cleaver with his glaive, circling it around so that its momentum was lost.
"Weak,"
Shagrak hissed through the froth bubbling from his mouth.
"Groth meat, fill Shagrak belly."
Groth snarled at his challenger and lunged for him with the cleaver. This time, when the heavy blade crashed against the glaive, the axe head was warped by the impact, and it was all Shagrak could do to maintain his grip. Groth pressed the attack, forcing the Bestigor back.
"Shagrak, fool!" Groth snarled. "Believe Shagrak strong!"
He brought the cleaver down again. This time, instead of denting the glaive, he gouged a sliver from its blade.
"Believe Shagrak mighty!"
The cleaver smashed down into the Bestigor's weapon, causing it to curl backwards at its tip.
"Believe Shagrak better!"
Groth swung his blade once more, this time with such force that Shagrak could not maintain his hold. The glaive went flying from his grasp and clattered across the ground. Sorgas expected Groth to run in and slaughter the disarmed Bestigor. A heartbeat earlier, and it certainly would have happened. But as the herd chief started to move, crazed shouts sounded from the darkness all around the beastkin. Crude spears with stone tips came flying out from the night. One of them plunged into Groth's leg, and he turned his charge into a stumble. The lurking enemies the shaman's magically heightened senses had detected were converging upon the beastkin. Just as Chagrak's followers had ambushed Groth and his warriors, so too were they caught in a trap. Scores of short, powerfully built hunters charged out from the night to attack the beastmen. Sorgas was surprised to find that these new foes were some strange breed of human the likes of which he had never seen before. They flung themselves on the war herd with a vicious savagery that was nearly the equal to that of the beastkin. In a matter of moments, many of the Gors and Ungors had been smashed down by bone clubs and stone axes. Sorgas looked back to the feuding leaders. The fate of their followers made little impact on their bitter struggle. Growling their hate, Groth and Chagrak fought with tooth and claw, raking each other with their horns, snapping at one another with their fangs. So intent were they on the destruction of their rival that neither reacted when the squat humans swarmed around them and cast nets over them. Bone clubs cracked down against the fallen beastmen, raining blows upon their horned skulls until both of them were still. The shaman could only watch as both of the champions were captured by the strange hunters. Tied to long poles, they were lifted onto the shoulders of the humans. Along with the bodies of the other beastkin, both living and dead, the herd chief and his rival were borne away into the night. Chapter 4. The trees were tall, their branches lush with leaves, their trunks thick and strong. Birds sang their melodies from the heavy forest shadows. Squirrels darted in and out of holes in the bark. The ground was carpeted in greenery, ferns and vines and grasses that sprang from the leaf litter in wild vibrancy. The breeze that sighed through the boughs was crisp and clean, just the faintest touch of cold in its soft caress. For all the beauty of the forest, Kyra noticed what was absent the most. These woods had no voice, no presence that reached inside her, that connected her to the land. With every step she took, she was reminded that this was not the Thornwild. This was not a domain of the Sylvaneth, however pleasant its appearance. This was part of the outside world, the realm of the quick-blooded races, and all their petty greed, senseless hate, and savage war. If anywhere in the realm of Gur could be said to have been cleansed of the blight of chaos, it would be the Sylvaneth refuges. The world outside bore the stains of the ancient battle against the ever-hungry dark gods. Kyra sensed the contamination all around her, even in a place as physically unmarred as this forest. However dormant or residual, the branch wraith felt it there. At any time, the taint might manifest, twisting the essence of whatever it infected. That was the true curse of chaos, that it could never be completely burned away. Something always remained, sleeping until a spark brought it blazing back in all its horror. Groth, the root cutter, would be such a spark, unless Kyra could stop him. If it wasn't already too late to stop him. Kyra felt the delicate touch of Ashia's hand on her shoulder.
"What troubles you?"
the young dryad asked. Kyra wanted to laugh at the question. By bringing herself into contact with the branch wraith, Ashia had connected their essences. Kyra felt the magnitude of the anxiety that coursed through her. This was the first time Ashia had ever left Thornwild, ever been detached from that spiritual connection with the land around her. It was all a strange and frightening new world to her, an experience for which she had no perspective to understand. Yet Ishia still had it in her to fret over Kyra's worries, not because they could affect the small band of Sylvaneth she led, but because of the burden they presented to the branch wraith herself.
"We are far from home," Kyra said. "It is strange to be away from the Thornwild's song."
She felt the approbation in Ishia that she and the branch wraith should feel the same. It was not a falsehood, even if it was a small thing beside Kyra's bigger concerns.
"There are some songs it is better not to hear,"
Yanir said, overhearing the exchange. She reached down with her long hand and brushed aside the branches of a small bramble bush. Beneath the bush was a decaying tree stump.
"The forest here would sing of its fear. the threat of the axe and the hunger of the quick blood.
Kyra winced at Yanir's words. Even the grey-barked dryad was not old enough to recall a time when the Thornwild was beset by such fears, and its trees murmured with terror. Such a song was vivid in Kyra's memory. It was something she never intended to hear again, something she would give everything she had to keep from the Sylvaneth of her adopted home. Everything. It was Kyra's great worry that she had not done enough. The Sylvan Conclave had entrusted the task of reaching Beastgrave and stopping the Rootcutter to her, but with the caution that the Thornwild's defence would be diminished with every Sylvaneth she took away with her. If it was already too late to stop Groth, she would be weakening them for no purpose. So it came that she decided to take only three dryads with her. Yanir, Ishia, and Nyis would have to be enough to prevail against the Twist Flesh.
"The Quick Blood must sustain themselves like everything else," Ishia told Yanir. "The beetle eats into the bark. The strangler fig burrows down through the heartwood. Beggarweed binds itself around the trunk and feeds on the sap. Broom rape feeds from the roots."
The branches on Yanir's head quivered with irritation.
"All of those take only what they need to survive. They do not set out to kill and destroy only for themselves to live."
The fingers at the end of her hands sharpened into thorns.
"But the quick blood take more than they need. They are never content. Their hunger is never appeased. They give no thought to what they do, only to how it will sate their greed, except their greed can never be sated. They will fell a tree and take the entire copse. If they are able, the whole forest will be consumed. They will reshape the land, remake the earth itself to suit them. Where the quick blood stands, there is no place for anything else. They must dominate all. And if they cannot dominate, they will destroy."
Ishia seemed to wilt before Yanir's tirade.
"Why are they so thoughtless? Why don't they understand?"
"Because they care only for themselves," Yanir said.
"No, Yanir," Kyra interrupted. "That is not the reason. It is because they are quick-blooded. Their lives are so short they do not see the impact of their actions with their own eyes. They cannot appreciate the things they change when they build their towns and plant their fields. They are not in the world long enough to know what they are doing."
The light in her eyes dimmed as she cast her memories back to distant times, to old stories and whispered tales.
"Even the elves, the tree revenants in Shrine, did not understand. And they were the longest enduring of the quick blood. They could appreciate the necessity of harmony, but even the wisest of them could not really understand. In each quick blood, there is the germ of independence, a blight that makes them reject their place." "Are they truly so terrible?"
Ishia wondered, regret underlying her words. Kyra knew what Yanir would say, but her own perspective was different.
"They have moved away from order, but in doing so they have given themselves their own purpose and role. The quick blood do not thrive as long as the Sylvaneth, but they have made that into their strength. They are swift to see and swift to act. They are immersed in immediacy, and because they are, they will strike out when they find the seed. They do not wait for the first shoot to grow."
"It is because they are destroyers," Yanir said. "What is worse than a destroyer?"
"The corrupter. The destroyer can only destroy. What has been is torn down, but something else may grow in its place. Corruption defiles what is already there, twisting it into something it was never meant to be. The only things that sprout from corruption are those that share in its foulness."
Kyra glanced about the woods. No, it was not the Thorn Wild, but it still had its beauty. The season of destruction is fleeting, and a time of growth may come again. Corruption endures, and once its blight has crept into the land, its purity is lost. Whatever is done to cleanse it, the germ of chaos will remain. Kyra heard the crackle of underbrush behind her. She turned to find Nyis moving towards the other Sylvaneth from the outskirts of the forest. The dryad's bark was chipped in a few places, and there was a raw spot that looked like it had been cut by a blade. Dark stains on her hands told their own part of the story.
"I have spied upon the twist flesh," Nyis reported. "They are Groth's war herd."
When they left the Thornwild, Kyra had decided to retrace the steps of the invaders they had eliminated and try to find Groth's camp. It was important to know what the situation was there, how near the monsters might be to attacking the Sylvaneth. Kyra drew close to Nyis and evoked her magic. Pressing her hand against the dryad, she let her energies flow into her. The scarred bark began to regenerate, and the fires in her eyes grew more vibrant as Kyra dissolved her fatigue. The wood on Nyis's hands flaked away, exposing a fresh and unsoiled surface. Nyis, the stealthiest among the Sylvaneth, had been sent alone to observe the twist flesh.
"I was compelled to seek a captive," she explained, and waved a hand at her fading scars. "It did not come easily, but I learned what needed to be learned before it died." "What have you discovered?"
Kyra asked.
"The root cutter left here 3 dawns past," Nyis said. "He took about 20 of his warriors with him. Another group left the next day with about twice as many twist flesh."
Ishia gasped at the numbers Nyis described. Yanir simply shook her head. Kyra felt a chill sweep through her. So many enemies and so few of them. She looked down at the ground, at the hoof marks that they had discovered. It was the trail of a pack of twist flesh. She was confident it was that of Groth and his followers, or else the second pack that had followed after them. That news made her think hard about the root cutter and her vision. Kyra felt that if Groth were already so powerful that he could threaten Thornwild, he would not need to sneak away with only a few followers. No, he had yet to go to Beastgrave and draw that power into himself. The second group of twist flesh was even more intriguing.
"We may be fortunate," Kyra told the dryads. "The slaves of chaos are fractious, dominating one another with fear and brutality. Given the chance, they will turn against each other." "You think the second pack is hunting the first?" Nyis asked.
"I do," Kyra answered. "If they are, sooner or later the two will meet. Should that happen, we will find the task ahead of us made much easier."
The dryads were heartened by Kyra's words. She did not tell them her other worry. If Groth was killed before he reached the mountain, how would the Sylvaneth find the obscene relic buried within Beastgrave? How would they end the menace not just of Groth, but of all the others who might seek the same power he sought? Kyra felt the uneasiness of her companions as they crested the hills and stared down at the desolate scrubland. This was farther from the Thornwild than any of the dryads had gone before. Even Nyis, who would frequently leave the forest to spy on the nearby Quickblood settlements. The scraggly trees with their contorted boles and needle-like leaves were strange to the dryads, alien to anything in their experience.
"What kind of place is this?"
Ishia asked, the branches on her head drooping as she gazed at the unfamiliar terrain.
"A place far different from the Thornwild," Kyra replied.
She considered each of the dryads before she explained the nature of the land they would have to traverse.
"When I left my home, I saw many things and wandered many lands."
She pointed to the scraggly trees.
There is little nourishment in the soil, for all but the very dregs of vitality are left in the sun-baked ground. Seldom does rain fall in such places, and when it comes, it descends in a violent deluge. Of one thing alone is there abundance.
She jabbed a finger upwards at the clear sky and the blazing sun. Nias descended the slope and caressed a rubbery cactus.
How do these strange blooms endure? They survive because they cast aside anything that is not necessary to them,
Kyra said.
The life here does not strive to flourish in excess, only to maintain the flush of life.
She climbed down to join Nias. Her finger brushed across the thorny arm of the cactus.
This one hoards the water of many seasons, saving it from drought. It does not expend itself by sinking deep roots to hunt the meager sustenance in the soil. It does not waste itself with delicate leaves to catch the sunlight when there is such excess.
The branch wraith waited while Yanir and Ishia descended from the hill.
We must follow the example of the life here if we would cross the desert,
she stated.
Conserve your energies. Do not overexert yourselves. Know that there is little nourishment to be drawn from this land. If there is trouble, my magic can sustain us for a time, but we must be wary of depending on spells too greatly.
Yanir set her foot beside the hoofprints visible in the dirt, the trail the Sylvaneth had been pursuing for days.
If we should catch the twist flesh here, we will be at even more of a disadvantage.
Nias was in agreement.
This parched land will suit the beastkin better than it will us, she said. There has yet been no sign of beast grave,
Kyra waved to the distant spires of rock that sprang from the desolation.
So long as the rootcutter is not near the mountain, we can avoid conflict with him. It will be our task to watch and to follow, to wait until they are the ones at a disadvantage.
Kyra felt the grim vibrations emanating from the dryads. They were as fiercely resolved to see Groth stopped as she was. When the time for action came, they would not falter. To save the Thornwild, they would all gladly sacrifice themselves. No, her concern was not timidity, but aggression. She gave Yanir careful scrutiny.
Until I give the command, we must all be restrained in our actions. It will be of little consequence if all the rootcutter's herd are killed, if he is left free to draw more twist flesh to his banner.
I will remember, Yanir vowed. It is not to my liking, but I will remember.
The dryad's promise would have to be enough, little as it was. Kyra was not concerned that Yanir would willfully disobey. She was fearful that hate of the quick blood had become so instinctive with her that the dryad might fall upon the twist flesh before she was even aware of what she was doing. The branch wraith hoped there would be enough warning before they came upon Groth's pack, so that she might weave a spell to join the essences of herself and Yanir. Melded together, there would be two minds to restrain the dryad's instincts. Kyra waved at Nias to take up the trail again. Accustomed to ranging ahead of the other Sylvaneth, she headed out across the barren ground. There was little here for her to blend into, so Nias let her bark lighten until it was ashen in hue, so that her body would draw less heat and the blood sap inside would not dry out. Kyra and the other dryads maintained a steady pace, keeping the warning against excess activity in mind. They quickened their march only when they saw Nias stop and beckon to them with her branches. Nias stood over a mangled carcass. Flies buzzed around it, and there were signs it had been picked at by scavengers. There was enough of it left to recognize it as beastkin.
I could not find the rootcutter's brand,
Nias apologized to Kyra. She turned the corpse over with her toe roots.
The haunch has been chewed away completely. Groth's mark could have been there.
Even without the brand, we know this is still the trail,
Ishia said. The branches on Yanir's head swayed as she studied the ground.
Little one,
she told Ishia,
this may still be the trail, but it is important to know that no other twist flesh has joined with the root cutter.
Her claw poked the mangled body.
He might have killed this one to take over its pack and to add more warriors to his herd.
Is there any sign that more twist flesh have joined those we have followed?
Kyra asked. She dreaded to hear the answer. Nias circled around the body.
I do not see where more have joined the trail, she finally decided. This may be one of Groth's minions that disobeyed.
With the twist flesh, it could also be that they simply grew hungry,
Yanir suggested. She seemed to enjoy the shudder that passed through Ishia.
Whatever happened, the condition of the carcass tells us we are only a day behind the twist flesh, Nias said. If it had been longer, the meat...
Kyra interrupted her.
It is enough that you know what details to look for. Is it your opinion we run the risk of catching them too soon?
Nias looked around, her gaze sweeping the terrain.
There is little here to hide our presence. They could see us from far away, if their other senses did not detect us first.
The branch wraith pondered that possibility. The quick blood lacked the Sylvaneth ability to feel the vibrations that grew from all living things, but she knew they had other senses that were incomprehensible to her. She was familiar with terms like taste and smell, but precisely how such capabilities functioned, she had only the dimmest appreciation. She only knew that creatures like the twist flesh had them.
We must be careful and watch for any divergence from the trail,
Kyra said.
Leaving or joining, we have to be vigilant for any change. At least there is nowhere they could hide,
Ishia stated.
Except for those spires of rock, there is nowhere they could be concealed. They may have dug themselves into the ground,
Nias cautioned.
Many animals find burrows to hide from the sun, and the twist flesh are a corruption of beasts. It could be they have found holes for themselves and are waiting for dark before setting out again.
Perhaps, Kyra mused.
But if our worry is unfounded, we allow the root cutter to draw farther away.
She let a sigh moan through her trunk.
No, we will press on. Seek signs that the twist flesh have gone to ground, if that is their strategy.
Nias bowed to the branch wraith.
I will be vigilant. The first evidence, and I will warn you at once.
The lights dimmed in Kyra's eyes as she drew on her magic. She tried to draw upon the essences of the desert trees. Though they were not so vibrant as the wildwood, there was a residual energy in them, difficult to tap into and with resistance to rapport. It was strenuous to try to draw information from them. As she had told the dryads, the desert plants focused solely on their own survival. They could reveal what birds might have landed in their branches, but as to anything that had passed, even a few feet from their roots, they could reveal nothing. Kyra soon abandoned the effort. They would have to depend on what Nias could learn from the tracks. The day grew hotter as the Sylvaneth pressed on. Kyra judged it wise to keep moving through the day. The quick blood became lethargic once temperatures reached a certain point. If the twist flesh had found burrows to hide in, there was a good chance they were too oppressed by the heat to keep a steady watch. The spires of rock drew nearer. Kyra saw the bands of coloured clay that were layered across their faces. Shaped somewhat like mushrooms, the vibrant streaks set off the dull stone of the formations to remarkable effect. Dark spots peppered the clay, suggesting to her knots on the trunk of a tree. Motion stirred within the spots, and Kyra saw that they were holes, not mere discolorations. When huge, hairy insects crawled into the light, they were bees, astounding in their size.
They climbed out onto the clay and opened their translucent wings to dry them in the sun.
"It must take a great deal of pollen to feed such bees,"
Ishia said, amazed by the huge insects. Yanir's opinion was more cautious.
"I have seen no flowers here,"
she warned. The bees took flight, first one and then another, their bulky bodies seemingly too massive to be carried by the wings on their backs. They spread out across the desert, keeping high above the land. It was clear to Kyra that they were searching for food. The nature of that food was revealed a few moments later when one of them dropped down and landed atop the carcass Nias had found. The branch wraith watched in astonishment as the bee chewed the decaying meat into little balls and stuffed the carrion into pouches on its legs.
"Oh,"
Ishia muttered, disappointment in her voice.
"I said there were no flowers."
Yanir relaxed, and her claws thinned back to twig-like fingers.
"If they only scavenge flesh, they will not bother us."
"But they may show us where the rootcutter has gone," Kyra said. "If the twist flesh have left more of their own butchered along the trail, the bees will be drawn to them. If we can't follow the tracks, watching the bees could tell us where they have gone."
Nias pointed at the feeding insect.
"I will watch for tracks. If the rest would observe the scavengers, we might regain the trail if I lose it."
The Sylvaneth followed the plan. While Nias watched the ground, the others kept their attention on the sky. There were many of the huge bees flying to and from the nests. The insects lighted upon dark bodies lying on the sand, the remains of antelope and buffalo. Kyra was worried about how many animals had died in the desert. It was far different from the forest she had known, where death was not so ravenous, and the evidence of its coming was quickly cleaned away. The giant bees took on a more sinister quality when Kyra saw why there was so much carrion. A big hog was resting in the shade of a thorn tree. It did not see the threat that hovered over it. Wheeling about the tree was one of the bees. It had an attitude of searching, looking for some way to drop past the thorny branches and get at the hog. After several circuits, the bee found the opening it wanted. Diving down at a steep angle, it hit the pig from behind, stabbing its long stinger into the animal's back. The hog squealed and struggled onto its feet, but an instant later it slumped back down. Its legs kicked for a few moments as the bee's venom did its deadly work. The insect crawled away from the carcass. Once it was out from under the tree's shadow, it flew away.
"They make their own carrion," Yanir said. "Leave the kill to rot and come back for it later."
"An awful land."
Ishia's bark was thickening, taking on a defensive aspect, bracing her for danger. Kyra eased the young dryad's anxiety.
"They do what they must to survive. No different from the wolf and the bear?"
Her mouth thinned down to a smile.
"Yanir is right. These creatures seek flesh. We do not need to worry about them. We have nothing they want."
Only a short time passed before Kyra doubted her reassuring words. As they continued along the trail, one of the bees circled them overhead. She thought the insect's interest was more ominous than mere curiosity. A second appeared, soon to be joined by a third, and finally a fourth.
"One for each of us," Kyra thought.
The observation did not lessen her uneasiness. The four giant bees circled for a time, as though debating what to do. If they could smell, surely that sense must tell them that the Sylvaneth were not flesh and therefore not their prey. Kyra had seen panthers claw trees to mark territory, but never had she seen the cats try to eat one.
"Keep moving,"
Kyra told the others as the bees tightened their circle. She hoped it was only their motion that had drawn the interest of the bees.
One of the insects dived down at Yanir. The old dryad struck at the creature with her claws, tearing its abdomen away from its thorax. The bulbous abdomen rolled on the ground, the barbed stinger on its end dripping venom into the dirt. The remainder of the bee clung to Yanir's back, its segmented mouth chewing at her bark. She tried to rip the thing free, but it resisted her efforts. Only when Nias ran over and tore the bee off were the dryads able to see why the creature had attacked. It had bitten down past Yanir's bark to tear into the wood within. The blood sap dripping from its jaws told the rest. The bee had been trying to get at the syrupy substance inside the Sylvaneth. A second of the bees dropped down to attack Ishia. Again the creature struck from behind. She fell as the stinger crunched into her body and pumped its venom into her. Ishia pressed her hand against the bee's head, forcing it back so the mandibles couldn't reach her. The dryad's fingers elongated into claws and punched through one of the segmented eyes. A scum of pulpy liquid gushed from the wound, but the insect was oblivious to its injury. Kyra moved to help Ishia. In doing so, she exposed herself to the bee that had been hovering above. The insect darted down for her back, a low drone sounding from its whirring wings. She pivoted to face her attacker. Kyra stretched her hand towards the flying enemy. A spell whispered from her mouth, and in response, a burst of brambles erupted from her palm. The mesh of ropey thorns covered the bee, binding it tight. The insect crashed to the ground and writhed against the living net that held it. Nias and Yanir were beset by the last of the bees. With mindless determination, it kept circling the dryads, seeking to come at Nias from behind while keeping out of the reach of their claws. The insect readied its stinger, wheeling away again when Yanir slashed at it with her hand. The deadly dance finally ended when Nias deliberately turned her back on the creature, giving it the opportunity it had been searching for. Before it could sink its stinger into her, Yanir intercepted it. Seizing the bee in both hands, she smashed it against the ground, not relenting until it was still. The bee atop Ishia continued to pump venom into her. The young dryad's grip on the thing's head began to weaken, and its mandibles dropped closer to her body. Kyra reached the scene before the insect could bite its victim. Her fingers folded into a sickle-like claw, and she swept its sharp edge across the join between the bee's head and thorax. Ishia threw the severed head away, while Kyra worked to pry the decapitated body from her back. There was a grotesque sucking sound as the stinger was extracted from the dryad's wood. A foamy green froth bubbled up from the wound. Kyra flung the insect's body away. Their own attackers dealt with, Yanir and Nias stood over Ishia. The branch wraith deadened her arcane awareness and shut out the grave concern she felt emanating from them. She focused all her energies on Ishia and the venom that had been pumped into her. The bee's sting was causing a disruption inside her, evaporating the dryad's connection to her own body. Left to spread, it would leave her an inert bulk, unable to twitch so much as a twig.
"Is there anything you can do to help her?" Nias asked.
Kyra let more of her own essence flow into Ishia.
"I can, but it will take time and much energy."
She looked away from Ishia and stared at the sky.
"While I work on her, I need you both to stand guard. Do not let more of the bees attack."
Pouring more of herself into Ishia, the branch wraith forced the dryad's body to repulse the bee's venom. Drop by drop, she compelled the poison out through her bark in a toxic sweat, a grueling, arduous process. The sun was beginning to set before Kyra was able to withdraw fully into her own form. A shudder swept through her as the fatigue of her ordeal struck her heartward. Her skin cracked and split, sloughing away in crumbling patches. By contrast, with the venom expelled from her, Ishia suffered no lingering effects from her wound. The young dryad almost looked refreshed by the experience. Her vigour evoked a feeling of guilt, and she averted her eyes when she thanked Kyra for helping her.
"I regret being such a burden,"
Ishia finished. Kyra felt like sagging to the ground, but she knew doing so would only upset Ishia further. She tried to turn the discussion to other avenues.
"We made a mistake and underestimated those creatures. It is reckless to make presumptions." "Why did they attack us?"
Nias wondered.
"And why only four of them, when they could have brought an entire swarm against us?"
The branch wraith pointed to Yanir's wound.
"They must have smelled our blood sap and found it enticing. It could be that the bees marked us in some way, claiming us for their own. Some special scent that would keep others away." "How long do you think the rest will ignore us?"
Ishia asked. Kyra could not give an answer to that. She turned to Nias and posed her own question.
"Did they return to their nests when the sun went down?"
Somewhat before then,"
Nias replied.
"I should think they went back to the rocks when it started to cool down." "Our safest course is to keep going,"
Kyra said. She felt the hesitance of her companions and knew they were worried about her fitness for such a march.
"We cannot depend upon the bees to ignore us tomorrow. Our best chance is to be away from their nests when it gets hot enough to draw them out."
Nias waved her hand at the parched earth.
"When it was clear the bees were going back to the rocks, I checked the tracks. They steer away from the spires and down into a sandy fissure. I found a few of their bodies down there. They were crushed and without a drop of blood. Whatever happened to them, it did not interfere with me. I was able to find their tracks again on the other side." "That will be our plan,"
Kyra decided.
"We cross the fissure and continue following the root cutter."
She glanced at the dark shapes of the spires.
"It would seem the twist flesh were as eager to avoid those nests as we are."
"That is to be regretted,"
Yanir said. She brushed her fingers across the raw wood where the bee had bitten her.
"I would not mind being bitten by them if they had saved us a lot of trouble and finished our enemies for us."
The desert was far behind them, but still the Sylvaneth seemed no closer to their quarry. Kyra knew the limitations of flesh, the weariness that so swiftly set into the muscles of the quick-blood. Groth must be driving his warriors mercilessly to keep them moving at such speed. Whatever brute led the second pack of twist flesh was no kinder to them, for they were keeping pace with Groth's group. Any question that the two bands of twist flesh had joined was banished after they left the desert. The second group had diverged from Groth's, adopting a parallel path to the one taken by the root cutter. Nias was able to differentiate the more recent trail from the older one by the freshness of the plants crushed under their hooves. She quickly realized that the tracks of the beast hound, which had escaped from the thorn wild, belonged to the second war herd. Sometimes its footprints would drift back to Groth's trail, then shift away to rejoin the other one. The creature's senses were letting the root cutter's rival keep tabs on him. The trail led into a foggy marshland. The mists that rose up from the stagnant pools were dense and had a slimy feel to them as the Sylvaneth moved through them. Kyra and the dryads extended their toe roots, splaying them out to create broad footpads and disperse their weight as they navigated the mire. Small animals slithered through the water. Kyra had to keep shifting her bark to dislodge the little black salamanders that kept crawling onto her. The croaks of frogs and crows echoed from deep within the fog. Twice the Sylvaneth stopped when they heard something big splashing through the marsh in the distance.
"We have not lost the trail,"
Nias told Kyra. She pointed to a stand of weeds where a big green snake was coiled atop the body of a goat-headed warrior. The swollen state of the corpse and its purple colour suggested the serpent was responsible for the creature's end.
"Forgive me for doubting your skill," Kyra said. "This kind of terrain makes it difficult to believe anyone could find tracks to follow."
Nais found humour in that statement.
There are no tracks to follow here, but there are other traces of their passing. The stink of the mire probably confounded the nose of their beast hound, so the other twist flesh have had to look for other ways to follow the root cutter. They were not subtle in their efforts.
She pointed out places where the moss dangling from the trees had been disturbed, patches of reeds that had been crushed down, floating warts that had been broken by something pressing against them.
Still, there is no evidence the two have found one another,
Yanir said. She jabbed a claw at the dead beastman.
We found one or two of them, struck down by some animal or hazard, if not by their own kind, but we have not seen any trace of a fight. Perhaps they are not in conflict after all.
Kyra thought that to be unlikely.
No, if they were united in purpose, they would be together, not stealing through dangerous lands.
A cry from Ishia broke into the branch wraith's speech. She shook her arm at the dense fog.
Did you see?
She asked.
Did you see the mist turning black?
The other dryads looked out across the marsh, but they saw nothing, and told Ishia as much. Kyra was not so certain. There was nothing visible, but she sensed a chill worming through her, a cold that had nothing to do with the absence of heat. It was the icy finger of black magic and old evil.
Ishia is right, Kyra said. Something is here.
She tried to draw a greater sense of what it might be, or at least where it was, but to no avail. All she could tell was that some malignant magic was at work, and it was all around them.
Can you describe what you saw? Kyra asked Ishia. It was just a kind of darkness, she said, like the fog itself was turning black.
Nias swung around and pointed to a distant stand of trees.
There, she said, I saw something that cast a black shadow over the reeds.
I saw it too.
Yanir stepped forwards, putting herself between the others and the suspicious reeds.
It was darker than any shadow, like the reeds themselves turned black and just as quickly returned to normal.
Kyra evoked her arcane senses, opening herself to the ether. The nature of whatever was out there remained nebulous. All she could tell was that it was a kind of hostile magic, and that it was hungry.
We must be away from this place, Kyra told the others. Whatever is here, it is nothing we want any part of. Some kind of monster?
Ishia asked.
I am not sure if it even has that much identity, Kyra speculated. It may simply be the residue of some powerful spell, lingering on far past its time, nothing more than force and energy.
The idea sparked an old memory of a quick-blood witch who had once preyed upon the Sylvaneth long ago. She had harvested the living wood of their bodies, drawing out the fey energies to feed her own enchantments. This could be a similar kind of magic, aroused by the mere presence of her and the dryads.
It is over here now.
Yanir drew their attention to a weed-strewn hummock a few hundred yards from the Sylvaneth. Kyra was able to see the last flicker of blackness before normalcy resumed. The brief glance was not enough to confirm her speculation. All that was apparent was that the phenomenon was getting closer. The branch wraith focused her magic into her fingers, their tips aglow with arcane power. The thing, the force, whatever it might be, manifested as a crawling shadow, an oily scum that rippled through the water. Kyra sent the eldritch light surging into the creeping malignance. If the shadow on the water had truly been oil, there could have been no less violent a reaction. The instant the blackness was struck by the light, it surged up, a geyser of boiling night. The dark cataract billowed outwards, launching itself upon Kyra, all of its slinking coyness forgotten. It fell upon her in a roiling shroud, swathing her from top to root. Kyra felt herself being smothered in that blackness. Every speck of her being felt as though sharp needles were piercing into her. She felt her essence drying out, withering away with each flicker of motion. Dimly she could perceive Yanir charging towards her, the dryad's hands transformed into great raking claws. Kyra tried to shout, tried to warn her away, but no sound would come. Yanir struck, and when she did, the black mantle shifted away from Kyra and descended upon the dryad. The branch wraith tried to focus her essence, bind her ravaged being back to her wooden body. She saw the hideous force swirling around Yanir. The glow in the dryad's eyes flickered and flashed, ebbing away as the thing tried to draw her out and consume her being.
Nias, don't!
Kyra tried to stop the dryad from rushing to Yanir's aid. Nias had her own claws ready to tear at the shadow. Doing so would simply transfer it from Yanir to her. Kyra could not let that happen. She wove a compelling imperative through Nias, preventing her from touching the darkness. Fixated on stopping Nias, Kyra could not restrain Ishia. The young dryad's right arm was fused into a great scything claw. The fingers of her left were elongated into probing talons. Kyra could only watch in despair as Ishia struck at the shadow and tried to rescue Yanir. Strangely, Ishia did not lash out with her right hand, but jabbed at the shadow with her left. When the darkness came swirling away from Yanir, that was the moment she struck with her claw. Ishia brought it scything down through her own left arm. Kyra ran to Ishia, helping her away even as Nias supported the reeling Yanir. The Sylvaneth staggered deeper into the marsh. Behind them they left Ishia's severed arm, floating on the water, a scum of shadow swirling around it.
Your arm!
Kyra did not know what to say to Ishia. It would take her centuries to grow another limb, and it would never be as strong as the one she had sacrificed. To draw out the shadow, she had left some of her own essence in the arm before cutting it from her body.
I had to save Yanir,
Ishia said.
This seemed the only way. There was not time to think of anything else.
Despite the strain it put on her energies, Kyra cast a spell upon Ishia, sealing her wound and preventing any more blood sap from leaking out of her body. Chapter 5. Consciousness returned slowly to Groth. The first thing he was aware of was pain pulsing through his head, throbbing from the gash in his face, flaring from the dozens of places where he had been cut, bitten, gored, and bludgeoned. The herd chief took a grim solace from his many hurts. They meant he was still alive. Groth drew a deep breath and forced himself to fight through his pain to make sense of the many scents that filled his nose. There was the sharp smell of burning meat, the meat of beastkin. There was the odour of blood, both dried and fresh, the musky scent of other beastmen still living. He could pick out his rival, Chagrak, the scout Togra, the beasthound, Frang, and several others. The smell of turnskin was absent, and Groth wondered what had become of Sorgas. Did he die in the fight, or had the shaman escaped the attackers? The scent of those attackers was strange to Groth. He had seen them when they clubbed him and Chagrak down. They seemed human to him then, but their scent was much different, stronger and more distinct, with a rotten quality to it. He heard them laughing like men, but the grunts and whistles they strung together into some sort of language were strange to him. Groth did not know if these enemies thought him dead, so he opened his eyes to the merest slits. He kept his head still and stared at the limited view his position afforded him. He saw a ring of stones and a big fire blazing,
Bits of meat, impaled on sticks, were leaning against the stones, angled so that they could cook in the flames. He saw a few bones scattered about the ground, and what was certainly the severed hand of an Ungor. Groth's jaw tightened. He was not going to end up as a feast for these scavengers. Carefully, he tried to move, testing to see how serious his injuries were. Trying to move his hands, he met with resistance. Through his pained awareness, it dawned on him that he was bound. Flexing the muscles in his legs and arms told him that they, too, were tied tightly together. Even a primitive did not waste time tying up someone he thought was dead. There was no purpose in trying to deceive his captors. Groth opened his eyes and shifted his position so he could have a better view of his surroundings. He found that he was in some kind of village, albeit far cruder than any man-flesh settlement Groth had encountered. The simple huts were fashioned from uncured hides pinned together with sharpened bones. Upright logs stood between the huts, skulls tied to their branches with strips of sinew. Racks woven from sticks held thin strips of dried meat and charred insects. The fire he had seen was just one of many, each with its own array of cooking meat. A central fire, larger than the rest, had a long stake laid across it. Spitted on the stake was the skinned corpse of a Gor warrior. The humans who had captured the beastkin were there too, crouched around the fires and tearing at the butchered flesh of Groth's warriors. These hunters were stoutly proportioned, with broad shoulders and powerful limbs, but notably shorter than men in the lands Groth had raided. Their bodies were much hairier as well, their bare skin visible only around the face and palms. Their heads had a crushed look to them, and a sloping forehead and prominent ridge above the eyes. The eyes themselves were large and dark, reminding Groth of stoats, weasels, and other furtive predators. Such clothing as the hunters wore was as crude as the substance of their huts, raw skins fastened with bits of sinew and dried gut. Some wore necklaces and torques carved from bones. A few sported fur capes and cloaks made from the skins of wolves and bears. Here and there, Groth noticed a piece of metal armor haphazardly fastened to one of the humans. A few even carried steel swords and axes. It was clear these were plunder taken from others the huntsman had captured. Lifting his gaze, Groth forgot all about his captors. His mind even rejected the pain coursing through him, focused entirely on the giant mass that loomed over the crude village. If there was one good thing that had come from his capture, it was that the hunters had brought him closer to where he wanted to go. Their village was built in the very shadow of Beastgrave. Groth struggled against his bonds again, his strength redoubled by his proximity to the mountain and the power that awaited him within. His efforts brought a derisive snort from a short distance behind him.
"Man flesh tie strong," Chagrak told Groth. "Not make free."
The herd chief twisted himself back around so he could glower at the Bestigor. Chagrak was bound, much as Groth was, with heavy cords about his limbs and hands. Beside him, equally restrained, were a dozen other beastkin, some from Groth's original group and others from the traitors who had followed his rival. Regardless of which faction they belonged to before their capture, they all looked at him with a desperate hope in their eyes, all except Chagrak.
"Groth stronger," the herd chief boasted. "Groth smarter. Make free now, man flesh catch. Wait, watch, time come."
His bragging did not impress the Bestigor, nor was it meant to. His words were for the other beastkin. He was justifying their hope in him, their conviction that Groth would save them. He wanted them to keep their illusions. They would be less rebellious that way. The herd chief shifted back around and watched the huntsmen. The humans were starting to become agitated. He saw two of them arguing in their weird language.
One of them, a massive man with a mail vest tied across his waist and a steel axe hanging from a strap around his wrist, kept pointing towards the captives and growling impatiently. The other was white-haired, with a short beard and a bearskin cloak. The head of the animal acted as both hood and mask for the elder, and his arms were banded from elbow to shoulder with circlets of gold. While the axeman jabbed at him, Bearcloak had his arms folded across his chest. At one point, he simply turned and pointed at the mountain above the village. The gesture had a marked impact on the axeman. His tirade faltered, and Groth smelt fear entering his scent. The hunter's discomfort only lasted a moment, and he was back to arguing with Bearcloak. Groth thought of the way he had to remind the shamans of his warherd of their place in the hierarchy. The human with the axe might be the tribe's war chief, while Bearcloak was likely some sort of priest or witch doctor. He was even more certain of their respective places in the hierarchy when the axeman turned in the direction of the beastkin with a big smile on his face. He had argued some sort of concession from the witch doctor. The war chief whistled, and a score of the hunters rose from around the fires. They hurried to join their leader as he strode to where the captives were lying. With a flick of his arm, the dangling axe was in his hand. He pointed the weapon at the beastkin. The huntsman trotted forwards and lifted up five of the prisoners. They laughed and jabbered as they carried their burdens towards a big stone spattered with blood. A group of women were gathered around the stone, each holding a crude knife. Groth knew what was going to happen. The flesh of the dead was not enough for the cook fires. The huntsmen were going to slaughter their captives. He bellowed in defiance and struggled once again to break free from his bindings. His actions brought the axeman over to him. The war chief called out to his tribe, and a few hunters came over to take the beast man to the butchering stone. Before he was lifted off the ground, an angry stream of grunts froze the hunters in place. The witch doctor came and argued once more with the war chief. He pointed to Groth and gestured at the mountain. The combination made Groth cold inside. Did the witch doctor have some presentiment about Groth's reason for coming into these lands? Was he arguing to spare the herd chief so he could go inside Beastgrave? Whatever his purpose, the witch doctor prevailed. The war chief curtly dismissed his hunters and walked back towards the fires. The tribe would have to be content with the five victims they had already